Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Meet Natural Cycles, the only FDA-cleared and CE-marked birth control app that's 100% natural, hormone-free, and side-effect-free. Here's how it works. The app analyzes daily changes in your body temperature to find your fertile window so you can plan or prevent pregnancy naturally. Natural Cycles is a clinically proven, non-hormonal birth control option that's 93% effective with typical use and 98% effective with perfect use. No synthetic hormones, just science. And if you're ready to start family planning, switching from preventing to planning a pregnancy is as easy as tapping a button. Plus, the Natural Cycles app makes tracking fertility easy. You can measure your temperature trends using an Oura Ring, Apple Watch, or our Bluetooth thermometer, which is free when you sign up for an annual subscription. Join over 4 million registered users who are taking control of their fertility naturally. Save 15% when you sign up with code RADIO15 at naturalcycles.com. That's RADIO15 for 15% off today.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers healthcare on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
I'm called to be able to work with and minister to or share or whatever that word is so that others' lives can be better by way of having them realize that there is a certain amount of accomplishment and glory that they're eligible for, and it's worth making the sacrifices to do it.
And our guest this week is Vince Tuohy. He is the head men's cross country and track and field coach at Division III Widener University in Chester. He has spent nearly four decades coaching at Widener. And Vince, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Matt. I'm happy to be here.
So as we are recording this mid-August, obviously getting ready for the 2025-2026 academic year, but what is kind of front and center for you as far as in your portfolio of coaching right now?
You know, I think every day I wake up with a particular challenge because I remember that our teams have not won a conference championship since 2022, which was difficult because up until that time, between 1991 and 2022, we had total, because we have indoor and outdoor track, 39 Middle Atlantic Conference championships. So having a three-year period here where we haven't won a championship, each day I wake up trying to face that challenge of, you know, how can we get back into the winner's circle and, you know, build on the tradition that we had built for the 30 years before that. So this year, I do believe, is going to be a year where we are still in the rebuilding process. So when we didn't win in 2023, we lost by just a few points in the Middle Atlantic Conference Championship. I had to rededicate myself to rebuilding the team. Now, there's some things that like have occurred over the years, and one of the big things is the fact that Widener University is very focused on health and human services. So our health and human services majors attract many more women than they do men. So my typical style of recruiting was disrupted a little bit just because I had to figure out how to attract men to a school that was on the rise, incredibly on the rise in terms of its status, especially with the pre-physical therapies, pre-occupational therapy, pre-speech therapy, and also physician's assistance programs. So now that I really needed to change my target with regards to recruiting. So this is, I think, year three of doing that. I can tell that we have a solid nucleus of men on the team. Now we're going to build around that nucleus of men that we have on the team. So, for example, last year we had the NCAA champion for the triple jump, and he was a sophomore at the time. So now this year we've attracted three jumpers who are coming in to become a part of our jumps team. We had another athlete last year who improved his jump from like 19 feet to 23 feet in the long jump. And the reason why he was able to do that is he became part of this core group of jumpers who were being led by the national champion. So that's on the horizon, the continuation of a rebuild. The good news is, Matt, is that I believe that our rebuild is going to last for a long time because I do believe that there's a great nucleus there. Now it's just a matter of just getting the word out to the streets that if you really want to become a good track and field athlete, Widener is a great place to do that.
Indoor track, outdoor track, cross country, kind of for people who aren't familiar, how do they fill in the calendar?
Yeah, so cross country is a fall sport. Winter track, or the NCAA calls it indoor track, and I think high schools call it winter track, but the NCAA sport, the official name is indoor track, starts in December, and then that will go from December until mid-March. And then on the final weekend in March, we start our outdoor track and field season, and that ends on the final weekend in May. And the events are different in that you don't have, for example, a hammer throw indoor because you can throw a hammer a very long way, and it's not conducive for that. So they'll have an event such as the 35-pound weight, which will help the athlete who's throwing the hammer to get himself established or herself established. And there's other events like the javelin or the distance of the high hurdles or the sprints are much shorter indoor. But it's a really great experience having indoor track and field.
When it comes to recruiting, what are the events that are the hardest to find elite athletes in? Like, are there certain ones that you've really got to work to find somebody who can do it at a high level, as opposed to other ones? Not that it's easy, but I would imagine a lot of the sprints and all, you've probably got a bigger menu of kids to choose from because, everybody runs.
Yeah. So regarding the recruiting and how athletes decide on which school to attend will depend on location many times. So, for example, it would be very natural for an athlete who's a cross-country runner to try to find a campus that has a more bucolic rural area to be able to run. However, we won from 2015 to 2019, over that period of time, we won four straight championships, lost one and then won the next one, even though we're a metropolitan school, we're in Chester. Although, at Widener, I don't know if folks know this, but we're basically a tale of two cities. So we have the city of Chester, which we embrace and we're proud to be from Chester. But we're just one block away from the most, I would guess to say, the most expensive school district in terms of per capita taxes in the state of Pennsylvania, and that would be the Wallingford-Swarthmore School District. So we have the Chester identity, but we do most of our training in areas that are a little different than Chester's, more suburban type places. So the reason why I'm answering the question like that is because when athletes are considering schools, we need to be able to sell to them the fact that we will be running in areas that will actually enhance their ability to be better in cross country. Now, if you can get an athlete who's willing to train and grow to go from, say, running 50 miles per week, which is about 7 miles a day, up to 100 miles a week, which is about 14 miles a day, that's going to take some selling. And we're going to have to try to convince the athletes to do that. So the athletes that have done that at Widener have been highly successful. So, yeah, so we need to work on that. Well, the other issue too, Matt, is that our throws program is probably one of the best throws programs in the nation in Division III. So athletes who come in and they want to learn how to throw collegiate implements, javelins, shot puts, discus, and hammers. Our hammer, shot put, and discus coach is a guy by the name of Tyler Williams, who's a Widener grad. He was fourth place in last year's Olympic trials, and he missed making the Olympic team by 20 inches last year. And he has a very strong presence on Instagram. So many people are reaching out to us with the curiosity of what it would take for them to be able to come to Widener, to be able to get a good fit there with at the majors that we have to offer and still be coached by this guy who is one of the best hammer throwers in the world. Right now, I think he's ranked 14th in the world with his throw from this year. So it's kind of complex in trying to figure out, you know, how to present the university to athletes who are looking for schools to attend. The other thing too, Matt, is like when the athletes are looking and the student athletes are looking to come to college, we ask them to really consider whether or not they have a vocation that they believe that, you know, a vocal where they're called to be there. We want athletes to truly feel that they can grow not only as young men into being professionals, but also grow as an athlete. So a lot of times we'll get athletes who weren't really that good in high school. They get good coaching. They have a good community. They're really into a good culture at Widener, and then they grow to become really good. Thus, we're not always looking for great athletes who have achieved great things in high school. We're looking for athletes who have the calling. They really feel called to be able to live the lifestyle that we would ask them to live in order to be successful. So that's a complex puzzle. We're always trying to solve it, but, you know, hopefully we can.
All right. So what is your origin story with running?
That's a good question. So when I was a young man, young boy, my father took me to a Franklin Field. There was a track and field meet there. This was in the 70s. I think it was 70s maybe. Yeah, just early 70s. Because there was a race going on at Franklin Field that day. I remember it was a rainy day. And it was going to be Jim Rine, who was the greatest American runner and the American record holder at the time, racing in a mile. And there were athletes, there were maybe about 12 athletes in the race at Franklin Field, but Jim Rine was racing Marty LaCorie, who was the great runner from Villanova. And they dubbed it the Dream Mile. And the name of the track meet was the Martin Luther King Games. And I was young. I had no idea what it was about. My father instilled in me this like amazing experience of being able to watch the greatest athletes in the world, who at the time were Jim Rine and Marty LaCorie. And the next year when I was going into seventh grade, I went to St. Gabriel's Parochial School in Norwood, Pennsylvania. They were starting a track and field program in the CYO. And I remember going and joining up for track and field, and I've been going to track meets every year since then. So that was my origin into the sport.
When you start, what are you running? What events are you running at first?
So I thought I was fast, you know. So I was like, yeah, okay, I'm going to be a sprinter. Even though I think back then the longest event that the CYO had was an 800. But all my friends wanted to be on the sprint team. I wanted to just kind of hang out with them and be with them. And I might have been the fastest or second fastest on the team. And then I went to the CYO track and field meets and got completely embarrassed and humbled by other athletes from these other parochial schools in Delaware County. And at that point, I realized, hey, you know, I'm not going to be that successful as a sprinter. So then I went to St. James High School after graduating from St. Gabriel's. I went to St. James in Chester, joined the track team there, and I knew at that point I was going to have to be a distance runner. So I told this guy, he was a brother, he was a Marianist brother who was the freshman track and field coach then that I would run. And I ended up running the mile and actually doing pretty well. And then I started to gain a sense of accomplishment, and then I just kept going from there. Made some friends doing that. I had a good friend from Interboro High School by the name of Pat Smart, who was the best runner on the Interbear team, and we started training together that summer. And I remember each and every day, you know, working to be prepared for the coming seasons and having having the challenge of getting out there and being intrinsically motivated during very hot days. And that's kind of how I grew into it through high school. Started to have some success in high school. I was able to get a scholarship to LaSalle. I went to LaSalle, and during my freshman year at LaSalle, I made a lot of improvements from my senior year at St. James. My senior year at St. James, I had set the Delaware County record for 1,000 yards at the time. And then I went to LaSalle and I improved that time by about 5 seconds. So I thought, okay, great. I'm going to have a great college career. But then I got lost. I got lost, you know, within the scope of trying to figure out the world, trying to figure out how to become a better student, even though I was never really a great student at the time and never really improved on that. And then once I graduated from LaSalle, after having an incredibly disappointing career there after my freshman year at LaSalle, of my own doing, just a lot of immaturity and losing my intrinsic motivation to always be prepared, I left there and was very lucky to gain a teaching position at St. James where I went to high school, at which time I rededicated myself to all the things in my life that I felt called to be doing, you know, the academics, the athletics, some of the spiritual stuff. And from that moment when I went into St. James until just a couple of years later, I was winning the Penn Relays Marathon. I was running pretty good back in the day when the big thing was in Philadelphia. And I guess all around the country, road races. There were a lot of road races that were going on. So I was always preparing for the next road race, whether it be the Broad Street Run, where I think my best place was third that time, or some of the other local road races that I would go to. And I really felt like that was a great structure for me to be able to rededicate myself, not to just running, but to being successful in all the dimensions of my life. Yeah, so that's how track and field kind of led me.
When you talk about your college, you can sense, I can sense the disappointment coming across in you. Do you think, had you not felt that disappointment from your days in college, you would be as successful as a coach?
It's a great question. Matt, there's no doubt in my mind that my failures during college led me to feel even more called, or actually it even refined my sense of what my vocation was. I believe that if I stayed on the right track of continuously being intrinsically motivated through the years where I was very immature, which my very young ages from probably 19 to 21, those are 3 years, 19, 20, and 21, I don't think I would have gone on to teach. I would have gone on to find other ways to fulfill what happens to people who are prepared, you know, become more successful, whether it not be in business or some kind of other occupation. But I don't believe it would have been as clear a vocation as my vocation became after realizing my failures. So I, believe it or not, I'm grateful that what I was able to do beyond my immature years of not being not preparing myself for the next challenge enabled me not only to refine myself, but more importantly, be able to know what these young men are going through when they get to this age and what it will take for them to stay as intrinsically motivated as possible through these, through this age of discovery. So I'm very thankful for my failures, believe it or not, at the time.
That being said, though, you did have some success in college. I think you held a school record with a relay team for that lasted for long years. You guys had in dual meets success. Was there something that crystallized in your mind what could have been? Was there a moment that you felt like I should have been able to do that and I need to examine why I couldn't do X, Y, and Z? Was it that crystal clear?
So this is kind of strange, but I can remember the exact place on earth that I had this feeling, and it was on the LaSalle outdoor track. I was a senior, and someone had asked me what I was going to do once I had graduated. And I don't know where this came from, Matt. I had no idea that I was going to feel this sense, but something came out of me, and it wasn't shallow. It was very deep. It came out of me, and I said, I am going to be a teacher and a coach. I shocked myself by even being able to say that with authority and with a sense of commitment. So I do believe that there was something happening at the time. Again, this goes back to a calling, and at that moment, that calling came on me, just came on me quickly. So I would say that I didn't go through life on those years after my disappointments through a sense of regret, but there was something in me that became my intrinsic motivation to not try to make up for the past was really enhanced, but it was more towards like, hey, how can the future be better? Like I was looking to the future at all times after that particular moment of, and I guess you would call it a revelation. So, yeah, but I wish I could say that I was like, yeah, I'm going to make up for my past times. I was like, no, man, if I do this, my future times are going to be much more enhanced. Now, look, compared to today and what's happening out there today in terms of the success and the times that are being run and things like that, what I was doing in post-collegiately was really nothing, not even like close to being elite. However, at the time for me and what was happening locally and things like that, I could sense, yeah, there was some accomplishment occurring. And at that time, I was like, I want to share this with the athletes that are in my life as much as I can. And therefore, I remember when I was coaching at St. James in Chester, my first year, I say, hey, guys, listen, you need to talk to your parents because I want you here at 7 a.m. 4 days a week for morning practices. We're going to run together every morning for 4 days every week. You have to commit to me. And someday, and the Philadelphia Catholic League had all of their weekday, like what they call quad meets on Wednesdays. I says, if even on Wednesdays, we will meet here at 7 a.m. and do a 3 to 5 mile run. Well, that was all born from my experience with trying to make the future a better place, not just for me, because I have to say, Matt, that there was some selfishness there because I wanted to get my extra miles in that morning too. But also knowing that if these athletes could be committed to this, they too would be able to experience this glory that was out there and available to them.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Vince Tui in just a few moments. But right now, I want to remind you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Well, it is summer, and that means it's time to bring the heat in a new Honda. You can head out on an unforgettable adventure, maybe take a sporty sedan for a spin, and you can do it all while driving with confidence. Check out the Civic, the Accord, or HRV during the Honda Summer Event. Contact your local Honda dealer today and see dealer for financing details. Delaware Valley Honda dealers, the best, want to thank them for their support of the podcast. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's get back to our conversation with Widener University head men's cross country and track and field coach Vince Tui.
The actual running, do you enjoy it or do you enjoy where it takes you? And I don't mean physically.
Yeah. So, yeah, deferred gratification really is what it comes down to for all of us. We're trying to defer the gratification. We know that. Yeah, every once in a while, these distance runners that are out there would be running and like, wow, man, I just feel great. I don't want this run to end. But that is a very – like that comes and goes like if you're lucky. What always happens, what is constant is that when – an athlete has finished a distance run, for example, or an athlete is finished doing a very hard track and field workout, like the sprinters or the throwers are actually spending hours and hours in the weight room or in the circle training. When they're finished, I don't know of a time when they're gathered together as a group where there isn't an incredible amount of chatter. Just they want to express to each other what happened to them, even though I don't believe it's conscientious, that they're not conscientiously doing it. They're just talking. So you got to remember, you could ask 15 guys to warm up for a workout. You could ask them to do 12 400s, and you tell them they're going to get a minute rest. And then you want them to be as fast as they can be under the circumstances with the rest and the number you're asking. There's not a word that's being said before that workout begins. During it, you could try to ask an athlete question and they're just going to ignore you, even though you're the coach and you want to know some data. For example, how do you feel or what was that pace? They're just going to look at you and just basically say, hey, shut up, man. This hurts and I don't want to be bothered, which is a great feeling as a coach where you know that the athlete that you're asking the question of is disrespecting you because it's more important for them to stay focused on their workout. Those same athletes won't shut up after the workout because they just feel an incredible sense of gratification that they were able to suffer to deal with this challenge that was in front of them, and they are now inspired to be able to do it later, you know, once they recover, and then they will have the next effort. So really, I think that the training, we can say, is not as enjoyable as the result of the training. So that, therefore, that, you know, when you release an athlete for the summer and you say, hey, listen, I want you to be running 70 to 80 miles a week or whatever the athlete is ready for at the time, you got to put them in a really good position to say, hey, listen, there's going to be many, many, many days, more days than not, where you are not going to want to walk out that door. You're just not going to want to, especially like this week. We know that's going to be 90 to 93 degrees all week. We have athletes running up to 90 miles this week, and there's going to be times where they're going to be like, I do not want to go out the door. While they're there, it's not super enjoyable, I'm sure, but the way that you get them to do it is to remind them of the gratification and the sense of accomplishment that they're going to have when they're finally finished.
So you mentioned that moment at LaSalle where you say, I'm going to be a teacher and a coach. What is the door opening opportunity that gets you into coaching?
Yeah, so that was kind of a mystical experience as well. I was working in the insurance. I had gotten a job. I was going to work in the insurance industry, and I was taking my insurance tests, and I was going to I was surrounded by these like men, you know, fathers and families, and they were showing me the ropes, and they were teaching me how important it was to have licenses and how much money, you know, could be made. And I was working and I was actually kind of excited about it because I could see a bright future, at least financially for myself. And then one day, it might even be today may even be the anniversary. I don't know, but it was sometime in August of 1980. The principal of the high school where I went calls me and says, hey, I just found out that my business teacher is going to leave teaching. I have no teacher to be able to teach these courses, which were basically like accounting and marketing. And he said to me, are you willing to give up the track and the path that you're on now to come in and give me a hand for a year and then restart at the end of the year? And then I'll get my act together and we'll get another business teacher. And I said, yeah, I'm willing to do it. So now I juxtapose that with that feeling that I had on LaSalle's track, and things started to make sense to me as to what was going on. And then I went in there, and next thing I know, I was teaching in an all-boys Catholic high school in Chester, Pennsylvania, with kids who were just like me 4 years before that. So that was the opening. The first year I did not coach because the head track and field coach was also the principal who had hired me. And then the following year he decided he was going to step down, asked me to stay on to coach. And then from there, I became the cross country coach and the assistant track coach because the head track coach was the football coach at the time. And we had a great partnership. His name is Marty Moak, and he was a really great coach and taught me a lot about coaching, especially organization, on how to organize a track and field team.
So what were the early years like when you're, you know, specifically with the coaching, like mm-hmm. when you're finding your way, organizing, as you mentioned, like, did you know what you didn't know? Like, how did you kind of build yourself out as a head coach?
Yeah. So the first year was scary. I can say it was scary because I knew that I had already started being intrinsically motivated to actually rebuild my own running. So I knew that was occurring and I knew what it took. And I knew that the culture wasn't there yet. And I was going to have to make some challenges. I can remember specifically there was a day, it was about 68 degrees. And I was like, okay, we're going to go run. And the one athlete says, no, we don't run in the rain. And I was like, so I said, no, we're going to run at 68 degrees and raining. And actually, it's going to be good for you. You know, it'll cool you down. It makes you actually even run better. You know, you'll feel better because your core body temperature will be down. So we got into kind of like an argument with that. And I remember that incident because, you know, it forced me to be able to minister to the young man, at the same time push him to be able to understand that he can get through difficult things. So that first year was kind of tough establishing the culture. I remember we had cross country meets at Belmont Plateau, and they were Wednesdays. And I can remember having to drive a 15, or I guess it was a 12 or 15 passenger van, because the school had a van for the first time in my life. So I've got to put these guys in. We had like 8 or 9 kids on the team, and going down there and just getting completely destroyed by these great cross-country teams from like Archbishop Wood or Monsignor Bonner or LaSalle High School. These guys were really good. I remember Archbishop Wood had about 100 guys on their team, and they warmed up jogging 2x2, and it was like a parade of athletes running around the top of Belmont Plateau. And I was like, oh my gosh, here I am with this scrawny group of kids from Delco. But from that moment until my end of my time at St. James, we grew to a point where we were on a big yellow bus, 3 to a seat. So, you know, it grew through. You know, I used to have to sell it. Now I'd go into the phys ed classes and look at the kids who just weren't – you could just tell that they had some athleticism. They had grit because they were trying the best that they could during phys ed basketball. They weren't part of a team yet, and I just wanted to offer them a place. So I would sit in there and just say, hey, listen, this is – I believe you could do this and you can be this. And they would go home, I guess, discuss it with their parents. Which brings me to this other point. So, you know, you got to remember, like, St. James is a community of people that have as their, you know, heritage parents who worked in and around the Delaware River, right? So in St. James and Chester, you had kids whose parents worked at Sunship, right? Or they worked at Westinghouse down in Essington, or they worked down at Whitco Chemical. Or they were working, they were basically Delaware River folks, Chester Pike, you know, and then realizing that, okay, these young men have no idea when you're trying to sell the sport to them, they have no idea what it is that the cross country is. I'm trying to explain it to them. Their parents are hardworking blue collar people who probably have no idea about what this is either. And you have to convince them to be doing something out of the ordinary, because it's out of the ordinary that a person on a Tuesday in August in 1982 would be getting the running shoes on and going out and running 7 to 9 or 10 miles, right? So you got to convince them to do that, and you got to convince them to do it based upon the fact that, you know, they have yet come of age, and what has been modeled for them has not been doing that. Those kinds of exercises, because it wasn't the culture. It wasn't part of the culture back in the 80s. So it was something that we took pride in. We took pride in the fact that, you know what? You know, we have hardworking, honest, blue-collar parents who are struggling down at Scott Paper. They got to get up in the morning. I remember this one kid. He was 1 of 9 children, ended up becoming the best runner in the Catholic League. His name is Mike Dolan. Became a great, great runner. He's 1 of 9 children. Grew up in Chester from the St. Robert's High grade school. And he just was like, yeah, I can turn this hard work and dedication into a kind of glory that nobody in my family has yet experienced. And then become a star, and then have people look to me and say, "My God, look what my son is accomplishing," or "Look what my sibling is accomplishing," and it became that. Now, it only became that because we had opportunities that were built for us, built into the Philadelphia Catholic League. So the Philadelphia Catholic League had forefathers; they were the guys who started this sport. Before they went to Belmont to Plateau, they were on another cross-country course, kind of across the street, which wasn't really cross-country. I think that they were running in the streets or something like that over in Parkside Ave, I think. But at the end of the day, we were able to take these young men from Chester, bring them to Belmont Plateau, prepared to be able to achieve great things, at least within the scope of what their potential was. They were actually competing against other children of these Philadelphia Catholic League teams whose fathers are probably doing similar things. Might be a Philly cop, might be an HVAC guy, might be a union iron worker or whatever. And their children were coming in and learning the same kinds of things. They came together and they competed in order to become better at what they do. And I believe that that was a great addition to the Philadelphia culture for many, many years.
You talk about where when you take over coaching, you know, when it started and where it got to. When was the moment, specifically at St. James, where you started to see it turn the corner and you started to see things are different? The kids are reaching different levels. The number of kids coming out. Like, how long did it take for you to really get the thing rolling downhill?
Yeah. Yeah, this is great. So the time – I have a little goosebumps right now thinking about this. So I have a vivid memory of the Delaware County Track and Field Championships. It was hosted by Springfield High School in Delaware County. And we had a very good track and field team. We had good sprinters. We had good jumpers. We had good hurdlers. And we weren't sure if we had good distance runners. But I knew that we were building. And this is 1983. And there was a guy who was running for a school by the name of Penwood High School, by the name of Leroy Burrell, who was one, probably the greatest runner to ever compete in the Delaware County. Became a world record holder in the 100 meters. Great athlete. Almost single-handedly won the PIAA championship that year by winning four events. I think there was one other relay that Penwood had that year that gave them some more points, that gave them the state championship. We were now in the thick of it, St. James Catholic High School, whose head coach was Marty Moak at the time. And the assistant coach in charge of all the distance runners was myself. And I knew that we had a lot of the bases covered for that meet, but I wasn't sure whether or not we had the distance runners. And I can remember to a man, every one of our distance runners stepping up to the plate, understanding that the lights were now on and it was time for them to perform better than they ever had, and they all did. So we set our school record in the 4x800 meters that day. We have a guy scoring big points in the mile. We have a guy winning the 2-mile championship, who, by the way, was Mike Dolan, by the way, as a sophomore. And I remember leaving that, Matt, that day in 1983 and saying, we have arrived. We are really a really good, not just distance team, but track and field team. And it was probably one of the best track and field experiences I had during my years coaching at St. James, being able to beat such a great track and field team in Penwood, whose coach was Bob Jessen, and he just was an incredible coach, and he was a real motivator. But it was great. It was great. And, you know, when you're at those track meets and you're really involved, it's interesting what happens because, you know, it's not like there's a sideline, right? And then across the field is the opposing coach. People are walking around. They're interacting with each other because coaches are coaching in different areas. But as the meet started getting on, we knew it was going to be close. It was getting closer and it was close. We ended up winning by just a few points. It's amazing you could cut the tension when you would walk right by a coach and just look at him and not even say a word to him because you knew that we were in the midst of a battle. And then when the team score gets added up and you realize we do win the meet, all you can do is just hug a guy and say, "Man, what a great competition!" So that was a great experience. And what reminded me of that is the fact that that was the day I knew that we arrived.
So you're having this success at St. James. What's the road that gets you to Widener? Like, what's the opportunity? How does it come about?
Yeah, so again, going back to the first question of when did I know that I might want to coach or whatever, and I could say, yeah, I can remember that exact moment where I realized, hey, I'm called to something that I didn't even know I was even called to at this very moment. During my times at St. James, I was also competing and running, and I really wanted to try my best to be able to develop as best I could as an athlete while I was coaching. And I remember there being some times during that where I was a little bit frustrated that I wasn't able to have all of the energy I needed to be able to continue to train and race because things were conflicting. So I was training a lot, I was competing. Even actually, it was 1983, maybe like within a week or maybe the next day. In fact, I think it might have been the next day after we won that Delco Championships. I won the Penn Relays Marathon, or it was a week later. I forget. It was very, very close in that period of time. And I started to realize that there was a tension going on between my calling to be a teacher and a coach and my desire to be able to like live out my intrinsic motivation to be as good a runner as I could be because I felt like the gratification that came with that. So there were times maybe over the last – so my last day at St. James was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving in 1987. So there was times from probably 1986 through 1987 where I was getting these sensations that I was being called somewhere else. I felt like I was outgrowing what I was doing. I don't know what it was exactly that was pulling me from my inspiration to work with these young men at St. James. Anyway, I get a phone call one day, maybe about 1 year before I started at St. James, and it was the track coach from Widener, who was a football coach who was asked to coach track and field, even though he had never done track and field before. And he had asked me to come over a year before that to give him some advice to help him set up the training and things like that. And I said to him, I'm just going to give you the same organization that Marty Moak gave me. So that I'm stealing from Marty the kind of organization that you need to be able to be successful here at Widener. And then I can help you with the training once you have the organization set up. So then he had asked me to come over once every 2 weeks just to have a meeting with him to see the progress of the team, which I did. Following summer, which was the summer of 87, he calls me and says, I'm going to be leaving track here. They're going to be looking for a head cross country and track and field coach because the cross country coach at the time was also the swim coach and he was leaving also. He goes, if I talk to the athletic director, who, by the way, was Bill Manlove, who was the best football coach, you know, in the Philadelphia era ever, won two national championships at Widener. He asked him to interview me, and he had an assistant at the time by the name of Bruce Bride. I went over there, I interviewed, and he ended up offering me the job there. And the year before that, they didn't score any points in the conference championship, so I knew I really had a rebuilding. I had to rebuild. And I also knew this, Matt. I had never been a head track and field coach before, but I was working under Marty Moak. So I absorbed everything that he had set up in terms of the organization. So it was easy for me. I had the formula because I had one of the best track coaches organizationally that there was in Marty. You know, we had beaten Leroy Burrell's team. We had beaten Penn Wood through this organization. And Matt, probably the easiest thing I ever had to do in terms of like looking back on it was smoothly going from just the head cross country assistant track, just coaching distance, into being a head track and field coach. I never felt overwhelmed by it because I did feel like I was completely prepared for that.
We need to take another break here on One-on-One. We'll get back to our conversation with Vince Tuohy in just a few moments, but it's important to remind you right now that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Well, summer is still here. We still got a few weeks left, so that means it's time to bring the heat in a new Honda. You can head out on an unforgettable adventure or take a sporty sedan for a spin, and you can do it all while driving with confidence. Check out the Civic, Accord, or maybe the HRV during the Honda Summer Event. Contact your local Honda dealer today and see dealer for financing details. Delaware Valley Honda Dealers, KYW Studio Naming Rights Partner. They are a great partner to everything here at the station. We thank them for their support. And now let's get back to our conversation with Vince Tuohy, head men's cross country and track and field coach at Division III Widener University in Chester.
Kind of the same question I asked you earlier about when you feel like you arrived at St. James at Widener. When do you feel like it really started to come together? Was it as tangible as you said it was at St. James?
Yeah. So the St. James experience, again, the one that is the shining moment was that Delco Championship. And then from there, we really advanced. But in college, I can say, and this is actually a pretty good story, we were building. So I knew that we were building on 0 points in the conference championship from. So now it's outdoor track or indoor track and outdoor track of 88, and in 87, there was 0 points. So I'm like, okay, one more point and we've made improvements. So that indoor season, we were really good. We ended up, because Bob Young, who is a guy who suggested that I coach there, did a great job recruiting. Incredible athletes had showed up. So he left me with these awesome athletes, one of which, believe it or not, was a runner for Penn Wood. His name is Rocky Wally, great runner. And he was actually one of the best sprinters in the conference. But as it turns out, we did really good during the indoor season. But by the time the outdoor season came, we poofed out. We were just burnt out. You know, as a coach, I made a mistake. You know, I didn't look at the athletes as people who have to get all the way till May. I just said, hey, man, let's get good as quickly as we can. We ended up getting second in the conference in the indoor championships to Haverford College, which was – they were a great team. But by that following May, I realized now we haven't arrived. You know, what we saw was a bottle rocket. You know, it just went up and poofed. We just weren't really that as good as I thought we were going to be. And then it was a battle to be able to figure out a way to get these collegiate athletes being able to compete well in a cross-country championships in the beginning of November, an indoor championship in or at the end of February, and then another outdoor championship at the beginning of May. And that was probably, I could say, Matt, one of the hardest things I ever had to figure out, how to get them to be good when the lights come on for three seasons in a year. It was tough. And I can say, even though we won many indoor championships from that moment on, we didn't win our first outdoor championship until 1999, which is a long time. So we were winning incredible amounts of indoor championships. We had won a cross-country championship, but we could not win an outdoor championship until 99. And then from 99 all the way to 2022, we figured it out. And, you know, we were able to just win almost every time we got onto the track. There were, you know, breaks in here, there, here and there. But I would say that the time that I knew that we did arrive was in 99. In track and field at Messiah College, I saw a Widener track and field team take a victory lap around the Messiah College track, and we had won against teams that were so good. Susquehanna University was so good. Messiah was so good. Juniata was really good. These teams were just good teams, and we had the full thing. We had great throwers. We had great sprinters. We had great jumpers. We had great distance runners. And then from there on in, I can remember when I coached, just like I woke up this morning thinking, how am I going to build this? Every morning I wake up and I'm going, how am I going to get these folks to be good when it counts? And it's a constant tension of making sure people stay inspired through a long period of time. Now, at this moment, I hope not to bore you too much, but all of this success that has occurred at Widener was really the result of these assistant coaches that I've had over the years. Almost all of them are Widener grads. Many of them have felt the pain of disappointment through their careers. So right now, my jumps coach is a Widener grad. My sprint coach is a Widener grad. My hurdle coach is a Widener grad. Two of my throw coaches are Widener grads. We even have one guy who just coaches high jump. He's a Widener grad. So I am so lucky that these young men have been inspired to be called to continue our tradition of developing athletes as best they can for three seasons a year. Now they're looking to me to say, okay, dude, all right, we have all these really good athletes, but we just don't have enough of them yet. Now get off your butt and get out there and recruit more athletes for us, because we know we can coach them. We know that we can get these guys to be better, but we just need more of them. And that's where we're at right now, you know, just to come full circle with regards to building the team.
Indoor, outdoor, men, women, cross-country, track and field, all these championships that you have won, do they all hit the same? Or when you think back, are they different types of emotions that different ones bring? I would imagine some are maybe just pure adulation, maybe some it's more satisfaction. You know, like, do they all hit a little differently?
Well, the next one better hit better than anyone ever has it, okay? All right? Because, you know, I'm sitting here at 39. I'm like, okay, listen, I, you know, even though, you know, I don't believe it has anything to do with that last 40th one. But yeah, some are more, I have to say, some are more satisfying than others. And the ones that are more satisfying, I believe, are the ones where the athletes who have never been able to experience the incredible glory that they know that with their efforts, the team was able to win. And I can see it in their eyes. And thank God today, Matt, I even have pictures of what it looks like. So I don't know what it looked like back because everybody's taking pictures all of the time. And I see videos and pictures, but just seeing particular images that are inspirational, and they're inspirational because we see athletes, for example, who might not have been able to break 5 minutes in the mile in high school, who are running times equivalent to like maybe a 4:16 mile or something like that. And they know their efforts on that day or at that meet enabled the team to win. So they're the ones that I think are most enjoyable. There was one, I think in 2015, we scored 323 points, right? Which is an incredible amount of points in a track and field meet. Like every event, we were just had people doing great things. But I don't remember one particular event where I can point to a person, boy, man, like you have never done anything like that. These guys were so developed. Even though I was very happy for them, they were bragging about the number of points that we had scored and you know, there's a certain amount of bravado that occurs. But the truth is that team was going to win with half of the people that were there, right? And that's because that's how good the team was. We had seven pole vaulters who scored in the event, I believe, something like that. So, yeah. So to answer your question, yeah. Seeing somebody experiencing the glory of being able to advance their team's success is probably the most gratifying kind of championship that I've ever experienced.
You referenced earlier winning the Penn Relays Marathon, thinking it was in 83. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've always been curious about, how do you train for a marathon? What I mean by that is obviously you run, but you're talking more than 26 mile, like as grueling as it gets. Like, how do you specifically, when you're going to run a marathon, are you slowly building? Do you try to stretch out long one day? Like, how do you approach it? Because that is something, my peak athletic was a couple of 5Ks, and I was ready to pass out at the end of those. I can't get my head around running a marathon. How do you approach preparing?
So I can remember the moment that I decided that I was going to run a marathon. Again, going back to the culture, the running culture in Philadelphia, and I think around the country, again, as I said, was in the early 80s. There weren't opportunities for post-collegiates to be able to go and race other post-collegiates the way there are now. For example, we have Widener meets, invitationals at Widener. We're hoping that post-collegiates come to be able to perform in track and field events. And when they come, our track and field meets are way better. So we have great runners that will show up, and we give them that opportunity to run, whether it be under their club name or unattached or whatever. However, back in the early 80s, when I was preparing, there were great road races. And we always wanted to go find a road race that was what they called TAC certified. TAC was the Athletic Congress. The Athletic Congress was something that Frank Shorter, who was an attorney and Olympic gold medalist, and probably was really he really won two gold medals. He won in 72, and there was a guy who beat him in 76 in Montreal, but he turned out to be a big drug guy. Frank was really the winner, I believe, of both of those marathons. He approached Congress and said, listen, we're getting behind the rest of the world. The communist bloc is supporting their athletes. They're putting millions and millions and millions of dollars. All these communist countries, whether it be the Romanians, the Russians, the East Germans, the Bulgarians, whatever it is, their governments are supporting them, and our guys are not allowed to make money as amateurs. So if you were found to be making any kind of income using your athleticism, whatever it is, you are not allowed to compete in the Olympics. So he went to Congress, and they listened to him, and they created this thing called the Athletic Congress, which made rules where athletes who are striving to become Olympians would be able to make money. But along with that came certifications, and along with that came rules and things like that. So therefore, road races needed to be certified. Now, the TAC, which is the Athletics Congress, became the United States of America Track and Field, USATF, which it currently is. I know that's a little bit of a tangent, but during this time, you were always looking for races that had the certification. You know, is that race a certified 5-mile race? Can we be assured that when that gun goes off, when you finish, you ran exactly 5 miles? So the applications that you would have to fill out, right, with a piece of paper and a pencil, would have to have say on it TAC, and it would give you the number, you know, pound symbol of what the certification number was. So there was this great certification that would go on. It was great. People wanted to go there. All the athletes from the Philadelphia area would go to these races, and you knew they would be competitive. And one of them was in a place called Collingdale, Pennsylvania. It started in front of the Harris School. And there were all these really good runners who would go there because they knew it was accurate. It was hilly course, tough, and the whole bit. And I went there. And I went there, and there was a lot of good runners there, but there was one guy there. His name was Mike Patterson, great runner. He was an Archbishop Wood guy, ran at Westchester, and he became a very, very good road runner. And I remember him and I going after each other hard. We were like hammering, and it went through two cemeteries, and each of the cemeteries had hills. And I remember on the final hill, the final cemetery, Mike broke me, and he won the race. But I run faster than I'd ever run in my life before. That was on a Sunday. The following Monday, I was doing a 12-mile run, and I remember in the middle of that run saying, I'm going to run a marathon because I can now suffer. I just realized in the middle of that race, I can suffer. I'm willing to do what it would take. So from that moment on, I just increased my miles. I went from like an 80-mile week guy to like a 90, 95-mile week guy. I started doing a lot more longer runs. I had prepared. I was doing some really good track workouts. Had gotten injured in the middle of it, which was a little bit of a thing that bothered me. But, you know, I had to fight through that. Yeah. And so really what it comes down to is, you know, at least then, is that the preparation means you have to run more miles. You have to put more time in. And it was built into, I was still coaching in St. James, so I knew 4 days a week I was going to get 5 miles in on those days. I dedicated my Sundays to running anywhere between 15 and 20 miles. I can remember one time I wanted to prove to myself that I could get through a marathon, and I ran a 28-mile run, which was kind of stupid because I wasn't really drinking much, but whatever, I was young and stupid back then. Yeah, so that was it. That was the time. I realized that I wanted to do it. And I also realized that in order to be prepared, I would need to put more time in.
Running a marathon, when you are actually doing it, What is the worst time? Like, is there a point where you know you are going to hit the wall? Does it vary from race to race? I'm guessing there just has to be an ebb and flow. I don't care how much you train. Is there a certain point where you mentally would know, okay, this is where I'm really going to have to fight through, whereas other parts of the race probably came a little easier to you?
Yeah, well, as it turns out, I actually never really, after that marathon, I never really seriously did another marathon after that. So I'm not the expert on that. However, just from my own experience that day, again, because I still can't believe, I didn't want to like take the risk of drinking during the marathon and getting a side stitch. It was like too risky for me. So I went the whole marathon without drinking, and I knew with 6 miles to go, I says, man, what a fool, you know, what a fool. And I really, it was really difficult. Since then, if I know somebody's going to run a marathon and I am like interacting with them, if they ask me for some advice, I will get on my hands and knees and beg them, please, I beg of you, every 3 miles, please put fluids in your body. I beg you to do that. Even if you means you have to stop for 3 to 7 seconds to just drink the fluids, please get them into your system. So the truth is that I believe that you're chasing your tail with regards to hydration, and almost every runner, sooner or later, if they really don't have it down as a science and get it into their system, with about 6 miles to go, they're going to be depleted and they're going to be running as dehydrated athletes. And then it comes down to just the mind. Can your mind tell the body that you got to push through this?
When you were racing marathon distance, well, when you were running, not even racing, but when you're running, mind space wise, what are you thinking about? Like, do you have certain things you focus on? Like, are you focusing on the race? Or are you trying not to think about the race? Do you let your mind wander? Does that help you to not focus? Like, what is your approach? Or do you really, whatever kind of comes into your mind, comes into your mind?
You talking about racing or?
Yeah, when you're running. Running, like distance.
Okay, so there is a significant difference between running, practicing, training, and racing.
Okay.
So I can tell you that the thought process in both of them, at each of them, is completely different. So when you're running, it's a stream of consciousness thing. By the way, I like even now to this day, I don't run anymore because I had to have a hip replacement. I just decided that that wasn't going to be good for me, just, you know. But what I decided to do is become a cyclist. So I ride bikes a lot, and therefore you can ride a lot longer than you can run. And yeah, there's a stream of consciousness that happens. You know, you just – I might be out there for 2 up to 5 hours on a bike and just thinking about things, mostly about the team, I would say. Mostly about like things that just come into your mind, and you know, and they become, you know, you can start to deal with unresolved issues. And I think that happens with most runners, is that they things will come into their mind and they have unresolved issues and they try to resolve them in their mind, or at least have a strategy for those things to be resolved. And that's if you're running by yourself. The collegiate athletes love to just chitter chat and talk about things, whatever is happening. But that's that college world where there's like arguments and there's different opinions and things like that. But generally speaking, if you're out there on a 15-mile run on a Sunday, I do believe that I would say that the majority of things that are occurring in the mind of a distance runner, I would say the majority of them are issues that have yet to be resolved. And I think they either start getting emotionally resolved while they're running, or they get a strategy to resolve them when the run is finished. I think it's one of the greatest benefits of long distance running, is that the addressing of issues. I like to tell my guys before big meets, hey guys, listen, don't show up to this championship with unfinished business. If you've got unfinished business, get it resolved. If you're arguing with your mom, call her up. Tell her you love her. Like, if you and your roommate aren't talking, ask him a question about something that'll open up a conversation so that you and your roommate can have a better relationship. I don't want you showing up when the lights come on and you need to achieve something under these circumstances where you're having something drag you down. All that can occur like through the strategy that you might gain while running your distance run. When it comes to racing, the most important athlete to ever run at Widener University is a guy by the name of Ernie Pitone. He was a runner at Cardinal Harrah. He became an NCAA cross-country runner-up. He was a 5-time All-American. He owns 5 of our school records. Springfield High School kid. And I just watched him train and compete. And if somebody said to me, what was the greatest thing that he had other than his like complete dedication to being prepared, was that at every moment of every race he ever ran, once he came of age after his freshman year at Widener, he was taking a survey of whether or not he is maxing out the best he can or the most he can physically. And if he's going past the red line, because once you get past the red line and you're developing way more lactic acid than your body can handle, you're not going to be able to perform well. And I do believe that while you're racing, the best racers are thinking about, am I at just below my red line? By the way, that can go on for 10 miles if you were doing a 10-mile race, a 10K, which is 6.2 miles. Any of these races, find my red line, stay there and get there and hold it as long as I can. And that takes an incredible amount of concentration and willingness to suffer, because when you're near that red line, you are suffering. So that's the big difference between the training and the racing.
My final question, coming back to coaching, all the success, all the years, all the championships in your coaching career, overall, what are you most proud of?
I think the thing that makes me feel most enriched regarding my last, I guess it's been 45 years between St. James and Widener, is answering the call to minister and provide a ministry, I should say, or guidance or whatever to support the people that are in my life. So I do. I'm a prayerful guy. So I like to get up every morning, pray, and I'm not that long, maybe 2 minutes. But at the end of every day, I will say this quick little prayer. It'll be like, "Help me find you through the day beneath all your surprising disguises." And I never get off my knees without saying, "Bring me the people." So deep inside of myself, I'm called to be able to work with and minister to or share or whatever that word is so that others' lives can be better by way of having them realize that there is a certain amount of accomplishment and glory that they're eligible for, and it's worth making the sacrifices to do it.
Vince Tuohy, thanks so much for coming in. This was great.
That's great. Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it.
And that will do it for this week's episode of One on One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Widener University head men's cross country and track and field coach Vince Tuohy for coming in studio and being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at One on One Pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
To remind you that 60% of sales on Amazon come from independent sellers, here's John from Devil Dog Pet Company.
We run our family business from Sterling Heights, Michigan, but we can reach customers all over the country thanks to Amazon. Good boy.
Shop small business on Amazon.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar-Free. First-round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app, available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart, for a healthier you. Smile Generation. Trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you, committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with Confidence Unleashed.